Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Czech story when we come back. You know, during World War II, our parents and grandparents planted victory gardens, and that helped to provide their own food and fiber for themselves and for their country. Well, today, over half the food that we eat is imported from outside our borders. Now, our food is produced from hybrid seed that will not reproduce, and it's nutritionally deficient. Adolf Steinbrom of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter into perspective by having samples of corn tested for nutrients that are usually added to commercial feeds. And when compared to more than 4,000 samples of hybrid corn tested in 10 Midwest states in a recent year, Steinbrom's open pollinated corn contained 75% more crude protein, 875% more copper, 345% more iron, and 205% more manganese. And the same result has also been seen in the content of calcium, sodium, magnesium, and zinc. And in the opinion of many ecologic farmers, hybrid seed merely masks poor farming practices by producing bins and bushels of foodless food without any nutrients, which are really food's reason for being in the first place. Now, if you'd like to know more about this multinational corporate monopoly of our seed and food supplies and how you can become independent from them, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. The Czech story. You know, most of us write checks every day. It's no big deal. We go out and we pull out a little book out of our purse or pocket, and there's a little piece of paper about, I don't know, 2.5-3 inches by maybe 6 inches long. And we can write this check in about 30 seconds, maybe 60 seconds if you're slow. And you can pay a bill. You can pay your power bill, your telephone bill. You can send it through the mail. It's safe. It's convenient. The money is automatically deducted from your checking account in the bank. Somebody else is keeping track of it for you. It's being done by computer. It's efficient. It's fast. It's economical. Everybody does it. And so, why shouldn't I do it? Well, a check has quite a story behind it. And years ago, an old man walked up to me. His name was A.J. Porth. And he said, "Would you like me to explain checks to you?" Now, the day he said that, I was probably 40 years old, maybe a little older. I had closed out my company, but I had just recently been employing 30 people, producing $1 million a year. I was writing a lot of checks. I didn't have any problem writing checks. I knew what checks were all about. C-H-E-C-K-S, checks. I'd been to public school, you know, and I've educated. You know, I got letters. I know about checks. But this old man, who was in his 80s at the time, twice as old as I was, and he had solid white hair. I think he had every hair that he was born with, and maybe a couple extra. Full head of white hair. I mean, just white as snow. And remembering that biblical proverb that says, you know, go to the hoary head, and I looked at his old hoary head, and I said, Mr. Porth, I'd be honored if you'd tell me what you know about checks. So I went into his office, and I sat down, and we were in there for 3 or 4 hours. I had just completed a series of lectures, and this was probably 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And he'd been there every single lecture. I mean, he didn't miss a one. And, you know, here I was, just a pimply-faced punk kid, 40 years old, out here instructing the audience. And here was this old man, carefully taking notes. Never went to sleep once. Paid attention. Finished the lecture series. I'm talking to some people. He comes up, shakes my hand. Thank you, Mr. Gordon. Pleasure to have you come. He said, now, would you like me to tell you about checks? Now, I hadn't been talking about checks, per se. We've talked about economics and income tax and a number of other things. But when he brought up the subject of, would you like me to tell you about checks or teach you about checks, I thought, oh, come on, what can this old man tell me about checks that I don't already know? I mean, surely I must know about everything that there is to know. Now, if you're a businessman, you know, you're a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer, you know, you're 40, 50, 60 years old, hell, you've been writing checks for longer than most of us out here have been alive. And surely you know all about checks. And so I thought, well, let's see, just how much do you really know about these checks? About our financial system, about the economy, and so on. So let me tell you a little story here. One time when I was a little kid, my daddy used to send me down to Harry Connick's Corner Grocery. Now, when I was a little kid, we didn't have big supermarkets. In fact, I never saw a big supermarket until Purity stores and Safeway stores start putting in, you know, some pretty good-sized stores after World War II. But during World War II, why, there was, in Eureka, California, there was a little grocery store about every 4 blocks. So if you wanted to know where to locate a grocery store, you just needed to locate about 4 blocks away from the last one. Just, you know, make sure that you're about 4 blocks in every direction. It'd be about 16 square blocks of residence. Now, there's probably about 8 families that live on a block. So if you had 16 blocks, 8 times 16, 6, 8 is 48, 8, 12, that'd be 108, wouldn't it? 128, something like that. You have about 100 families that you would service, wouldn't you? And that's the way the city was divided up. Now, people didn't go to the grocery store to buy all their groceries. They went to the grocery store to buy bread and milk. You know, people in the city, they don't bake bread and they don't have milk. But people in the city would buy things, you know, like 100 pounds of pinto beans, 100 pounds of flour, 100 pounds of cornmeal. And they had these sacks in what they called the pantry. And, you know, if you needed flour, you had these bins, there's 2 bins in the kitchen, and you pull out the bin, scoop out your flour, pull out the bin, scoop out your sugar. So sugar came in 100-pound sacks, flour came in 100-pound sacks, pinto beans, cornmeal came 100-pound sacks. And everybody had these 4, 5, 6, 8 sacks, you know, in the pantry, and you went in the pantry and got what you needed, and you cooked with it. People used to cook in those days. I know that's a new and wild idea for most of you people today, but didn't have restaurants. You know, we had a few, but not very many. McDonald's hadn't been heard of yet. Well, my daddy'd send me down to Harry Connick's Corner Grocery, get bread and milk, you know, a bottle of ketchup or mayonnaise or sandwich spread or something like that. And so when he sent me down there, I'm a little kid, 5 years old, can't be trusted with 35 cents. Hey, my God. Some wild kid might come along, you know, and rob me and steal the 35 cents. My dad would write a little note. He'd take a 3x5 card and he'd write a little note on there, say something like, Dear Harry, please give little Georgie a quart of milk and a loaf of bread. And thank you very much, and P.S. I'll pay you when I see you. And then he'd give me the note and I'd go down to Harry. Now, I went down to Harry and gave him the note. And in those days, you know, people didn't just wander around the store. You walked into the store up to the counter, and then behind the counter were all the goods. And so he'd go around, he'd get what you wanted and bring it and put it on the counter, and he'd sell it to you. So he got the bread and milk, he put it in a bag, and he walked me over to the door, and then he tucked that bag under my arm, and then he'd point to home. It's about a half a block away, three doors up, across 17th Street there in Eureka, California. He'd say, "Now, little Georgie, you go right straight home. Take this home to your daddy." And so I'd leave the store, and I'd start walking up the street, walking up 8th Street, and a legal question arises. Who owns the bread and milk when little Georgie leaves the store? Who owns the bread and milk when little Georgie leaves the store? Now, you've probably heard that possession is 9 points of the law. Little Georgie's in possession of the bread and milk, therefore Georgie owns the bread and milk. Or, perhaps, you've heard of the law of contracts. This 3 of 5 card constitutes a contract for which the contract has not been fulfilled, that is, payment hasn't been made. Therefore, the owner of the bread and milk is Harry Connick until he's been paid. Even though the bread and milk may be consumed long before Harry gets paid, but Harry now has a contract that he could sue on. You know, if push ever came to shove, he could go to Judge Judy and say, "I made a contract, sold little Georgie a quarter of milk and a loaf of bread. His daddy signed the contract, didn't pay me, and therefore I want you to enforce payment for him." He could probably do that. Or a third alternative would be Daddy Gordon owns the bread and milk, which is kind of a wild idea because Daddy Gordon isn't in possession and Daddy Gordon hasn't paid for the bread and milk. So how could Daddy Gordon own the bread and milk when he hasn't paid for it and ain't in possession of it? So there's your three alternatives. So you mold that one over a little bit, boys and girls, and come to a conclusion there. And if you came to the conclusion that Daddy Gordon owns the bread and milk, you're right. Maybe as Judge or Justice Douglas used to say, you're right, but for all the wrong reasons. But, you know, that's correct. Or if you said Harry Connick owns the bread and milk, good reasoning, good logic on your part. Hell, he hadn't been paid. And little Georgie's in possession. If you said little Georgie's in possession, therefore he owns the bread and milk, it's incorrect, but it's good logic. I mean, 9 points of the law is the guy that possesses it. But if that was the case, then Greyhound Package Express would own the package that it's transporting, and it clearly does not. Greyhound Package Express may hold the goods and be transporting it long distances, but they don't own it. They're an agent. Nothing more, nothing less. And so little Georgie, in reality, is an agent of his daddy. He doesn't own the bread and milk. He's in possession, but he's an agent in possession. He's not a principal, so he doesn't own it. Harry gave up title to the bread and milk when little Georgie walked across the threshold of his store, and Harry accepted the note or the contract in substitution for the bread and milk. And this is the way ownership transfers from one person to another. It's by alienation. Can you say alienation, boys and girls? All right, now if you can say alienation, we don't need to spell it just yet, but alienation, that's the way you transfer your ownership to somebody else. You alienate yourself. You abandon your property. You give your property to somebody. You transfer it. And so here's Harry voluntarily transferring his property to little Georgie, the agent of his daddy. And under the Uniform Commercial Code, Daddy Gordon now becomes the new owner of the property. He's not even in physical possession of it, but he's now the owner. And there's a little story that goes along with that. 20 years after the enactment of the Federal Reserve Act on June 5, 1933, Congress enacted House Joint Resolution 192 to suspend the gold standard and abrogate the gold clause. The resolution declared that, whereas the holding or dealing in gold affects the public interest, and are therefore subject to proper regulation and restriction. And whereas the existing emergency has disclosed that provisions of obligations which purport to give the obligee a right to require payment in gold or a particular kind of coin or currency are inconsistent with the declared policy of Congress in the payment of debts. This resolution declared that any obligation requiring payment in gold or a particular kind of coin or currency or in an amount in money of the United States measured thereby is declared to be against public policy. And every obligation heretofore or hereafter incurred shall be discharged upon payment, dollar for dollar, in any coin or currency which at the time of payment is legal tender for public and private debts. Now, interestingly enough, the words do not talk about payment of debt. No mention here in this House Joint Resolution of payment of debt. But clearly states that every obligation shall be discharged. Discharged. Now, that's pretty important there, boys and girls, because if you were a lawyer and you were going to law school here, then we'd have to come up with a modality or a method of distinguishing between payment and discharge. And so as the teacher, I would say, all right, now, children, let us learn the distinction between a payment at law and a discharge in equity. Discharge. You get discharged from the army. You get discharged from the hospital. And you can discharge a debt. Now, there's a word called payment. You can pay a debt. You can pay your hospital bill. Well, what's the difference? Well, in Stanek versus White, cited at 172 Minnesota 390, this judge lays it out about as clear as any judge that I've seen. Now, it's pretty obfuscated, but I think it's fair to middle and clear. Let's see if we can understand this. The judge said, there is a clear distinction between a debt discharged and a debt paid. Okay, pause right there. Period. This judge says there's a clear distinction between a debt that is being discharged and a debt that is being paid. Now, the debt to Harry Connick has not been paid, but it has been discharged. Because if little Georgie went into Harry Connick's store and just took the bread and milk, he'd be shoplifting. He'd be stealing. So it's imperative in a discharge, then, that we get the owner's permission to take the goods, but we're not going to pay him. Harry Connick hasn't been paid, but he clearly gave up. He alienated himself from his goods. That's the distinction. Now, we've got a debt here. The debt's been discharged, but it hasn't been paid. Now, we expect this debt to be paid someday. We don't know when, but someday. So, when this debt is discharged, the debt continues to exist, even though the debt has been divested of its legal character as a legal obligation during the operation of the discharge. So when we discharge this debt, when we present this 3x5 card to Harry, if he will accept it, the debt continues to exist even though the debt has been discharged by the tendering of the 3x5 card. The 3x5 card, which promises to pay, remember it says, P.S. I will pay you when I see you. The card, the 3x5 card, is a promise to pay at some future date. That's what a discharge is. Something of the original vitality of the debt continues to exist. Well, indeed it does. The 35-cent debt for the bread and milk continues to exist even though it's been discharged, even though Harry has given permission for little Georgie to take the bread and milk. Something of the original vitality of the debt continues to exist, which may be transferred, even though the transferee takes it subject to its disability incident to the discharge. So this 3x5 card has a disability. It is actually not 35 cents in coin. Harry can't take the card and go down to Sears or go over to the coffee klatch and get donuts and coffee with this 3x5 card nearly as easy as he could with a quarter and a dime. But he accepts this 3x5 card. He accepts this disability, this inconvenience, which is incident to this discharge. The incident to this business transaction of transferring his bread and milk to little Georgie, the agent of his daddy. Now, the fact that it carries something which may be a consideration for a new promise to pay, so as to make an otherwise worthless promise. This 3x5 card is actually just a worthless promise. But we want to turn this into a legal obligation, makes it the subject of transfer by assignment. So Harry then has taken an assignment, that is the 3x5 card, in lieu of his property, the bread and milk, and he voluntarily transferred it. It's called a transfer by assignment. He hasn't been paid yet, but he's transferred his property to Daddy Gordon through this process. Now, in 1933, President Roosevelt did away with gold. They came up with this House Joint Resolution 192, and indeed they needed to. They had a goal. They had a plan in mind. And it was necessary to implement the first and fifth planks to the Communist Manifesto. They would have to divest the American people of their gold and silver coin, which is the means by which the people make payment. Payment. Remember, we don't have any payment mentioned in House Joint Resolution 192. It's discharge. So they're going to convert us from payments to discharge. And they did. Now, it's clear that as a result of House Joint Resolution 192, and from that day forward, June 5, 1933, that no one has been able to pay a debt. From that day forward, no one's been able to pay a debt. All they can do is tender in transfer of debt so that the debt is perpetual. So you take a Federal Reserve note in and you put it on the counter and you walk out with the tennis shoes. And a legal question arises. When you go into the store, go into Walmart, and you pick out a pair of tennis shoes and you walk up to the clerk and you give her daddy's note, a Federal Reserve note for $50, and you walk out of Walmart with the tennis shoes, a legal question arises. Who owns those tennis shoes when you walk out of the store? Walmart, because they haven't been paid. See, that Federal Reserve note is not payment. It's a note. It says right at the top of it, Federal Reserve note. It's not a payment. It's a discharge. And you're the agent of the Federal Reserve. You walk out of the store with the tennis shoes, and you can wear them. Hell, little Georgie could eat the bread and drink the milk on the way home. He might have to answer to his daddy when he gets there, and you might have to answer to your daddy someday, the Federal Reserve. But that's who owns the tennis shoes when you walk out of the Walmart store. And Walmart has voluntarily alienated themselves from their property. You haven't shoplifted or stolen those shoes. Well, now, isn't that just something real special? Now, the suspension of the gold standard and prohibition against paying debts removed the substance that common law operates upon. The Ten Commandments requires thou shalt not steal. The Ten Commandments requires that you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. So the substance, that is the gold or the silver, the substance, that is the physical payment to trade for the tennis shoes, has been removed. It's been removed and put in Fort Knox and created a void as far as the law was concerned. The substance was replaced with a public national credit system where debt is called money, and the Federal Reserve calls that monetized debt. They take these notes, 3x5 cards, Federal Reserve notes, and they monetize it. They call that debt. So you take this Federal Reserve obligation, you run around using it like money, over which the only jurisdiction is Admiralty and Maritime. No common law jurisdiction here. So Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 prohibits the state from making anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debt. That's your Constitution. Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 prohibits the states. No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Well, then, what are these Federal Reserve notes? They're not a payment of debt. They're a discharge. They're a 3x5 card in place of the gold coin. But this article does not contain an absolute prohibition against the states making something else a tender in transfer of the debt. And that's what the Federal Reserve Note is. It's a tender, a legal tender, in transfer of the debt. It's not payment. House Joint Resolution 192 prohibits payment of debt and substitutes in its place a discharge of an obligation, thereby not only subverting but totally bypassing the absolute prohibition so carefully engineered into the Constitution. Well, in 1985, there is nothing for Article 1, Section 10 to operate upon, just as there is nothing for common law to operate upon. Perpetual debt, bills, notes, checks, and credits all fall within a totally different jurisdiction than that contemplated by Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1, and that jurisdiction belongs exclusively to the law of admiralty and maritime. Now, oftentimes people will say, well, you know, the law requires, the Constitution requires. Boys and girls, you voluntarily accept those Federal Reserve notes. Now, I mentioned this to you before. I mean, you know, if you want to join the club, you know, sign up for Social Security, then go down here and sign an employment contract so you can be a greeter at the door at Walmart. They'll pay you every week with a check. I mean, if you want to deal in bills and notes and unjust weights and balances and commercial paper and discharge your obligations in equity rather than pay your debts at law with gold and silver coin, you can certainly do that. I took a look at this some years back, and I said, no, I think I'll stop doing that. So I rescinded Social Security, and I started dealing in gold and silver, and now I'm on a gold standard rather than paper. And I discovered that the taxes due on gold and silver are non-existent, very minimal at best, and non-existent, you know, at best, and very minimal at worst. And I don't have any bank accounts, checking accounts. I don't work for Walmart. I'm a trader at law on a cash basis without recourse to standard dollars lawful money. But our standard dollars lawful money came back to us in 1986. Notice here, 1985, there was nothing for Article 1, Section 10 to operate on, but 1986 there was, because Congress reenacted the gold clause. They repealed House Joint Resolution 192. And they wrote into our Title 31, Section 5101 through 5112, they put our gold clause back in. So now we can pay our debts at law. Most of us don't, but we could if we wanted to. So let me suggest that maybe you might start thinking about paying your debts at law. A wild new idea, I know. So House Joint Resolution 192 prohibits payment of debt. It substitutes in its place a discharge of an obligation. And it's easy to see how bills as plenty as oak leaves polluted the laws after the War for Independence, as described by Pelletiah Webster. 20 years after enactment of the Federal Reserve Act, on June 5, 1933, Congress enacted House Joint Resolution 192 to suspend the gold standard and abrogate the gold clause. They didn't do that for no good reason. I mean, they had a motive in mind. We'd been getting along with gold and silver coin for the previous 3,000 years, you know. All of a sudden, here comes our government along, and they want to replace that with Federal Reserve notes. They didn't take your gold away for no good reason, kids. There's a good reason for that. So House Joint Resolution 192 places every person who deals in the public national credit in the legal position of a merchant, and the only jurisdiction over any controversy involving this subject matter is Admiralty and Maritime. And obviously, if we cannot pay our debts at law, we're also benefiting from limited liability under the Limited Liability Act when we use this credit, and that is marine insurance. Now, the definitions of liability and insure will help demonstrate this fact. In analyzing these definitions, we should keep in mind the distinction between payment and discharge. Remember that, payment and discharge. Liability. The word is a broad term, and it has been defined to mean all character of debts and obligations of any kind of debt, of liability, either absolute or contingent, express or implied. Condition, which creates a duty to perform an act immediately or in the future, a duty to pay money or to perform some other service, the state of being bound or obligated in law or justice to do, pay, or to make good on something. That's what a liability is. Now, to insure, to engage, to indemnify a person against pecuniary loss from specified perils or possible liability. So the following questions demand an answer. First of all, who do you suppose took possession of the treasury of the state of Pennsylvania on June 5, 1933, the moment that House Joint Resolution 192 made it impossible for the state of Pennsylvania to pay its debts? And two, since land titles are allodial in Pennsylvania, what was the state assembly's authority and jurisdiction to pledge these allodiums to the Federal Reserve as security for loan contracts from the federal government? And three, if the individual citizens of Pennsylvania were sovereign under the common law, what was the authority and jurisdiction of the state assembly to pledge their labor to the Federal Reserve pool? Three questions, three legal questions here. Well, clearly, the alleged authority and jurisdiction is the so-called public policy declared by Congress, which will be addressed later. Since all the assets of the United States have been hypothecated, that's a big word, can you say hypothecated, boys and girls, to the Federal Reserve pool as security for the maritime loan and insurance underwriting policy, other questions arise, such as, number one, if the United States dies or is merged under a one-world government, who gets this pool of assets? And two, if the Federal Reserve dies by way of getting its charter rescinded, then who gets the pool? Well, the answer lies in the statutes. Should the Federal Reserve Bank be dissolved or go into liquidation, any surplus remaining after the payment of all debts, dividend requirements, as herein before provided, and the par value of the stock shall be paid to and become the property of the United States of America, and shall be similarly applied. So the Congress could abolish the Federal Reserve in the morning, hypothecate all the assets back to the people. They're not going to do that. I'm not suggesting that that's going to happen. I'm just telling you that it could. And the Federal Reserve is a corporation created by the Congress of the United States. And the Federal Reserve owns your shorts. They own your house, your car, and they own you too. And they own your children. And that's because they've all been hypothecated, because we have changed our law from thou shalt not steal to the abolition of all right to property under the first plank to the Communist Manifesto. It's just that simple. Now, if you want to join that club, be my guest. But when you join that club, there are some liabilities that go along with it, like the national debt, and so there's a joint and several responsibility that goes with the national debt. Did you know that? Yep. Joint and several liability. It comes under Deuteronomy chapter 28. Let me read it to you. As they say down at the Blue Room, read them and weep as you get dealt your cards. Deuteronomy 28:68, and the Eternal shall bring you into Egypt again with ships by the way whereof I spoke unto you, that you shall see it no more again. And there you shall be sold unto your enemies for bondsmen and bondwomen, and no man shall buy you. Now, I explained to you yesterday why it is no man shall buy you. And that's because under this theory of the Department of Human Resources, the state owns you. And when the United States of America goes into receivership, unable to pay its debts, all of you citizens of the United States are going to be sold because you're the chattel property of those states, the state of Texas. Remember Jim Maddox? The state of Texas owns you. And you're going to be sold to the Ethiopians, the Libyans, and the Egyptians to satisfy that debt that you, with your Social Security number, have taken on as a liability. It's called joint and several liability. That is, if all the people of the United States of America cannot pay that national debt, then you, Joe Sixpack, have agreed to pay the whole $9 trillion all by yourself, Joe. Boy, that was really big of you. You know that, Joe? Gonna pay the whole thing all by yourself. You know, that's what liability is all about, and that's what insured means. Insured. That's called an insurance underwriter. To insure, to underwrite, to be a co-signer. Now, what did our God tell us about suretyship and co-signing? Huh? Six statutes. Told you, don't you think about co-signing here, boys and girls. That's bad. Bad for you. Yeah, I got to remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries worldwide daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about The Law Hour and The Law School, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, nonprofit, non-sectarian, non-commercial law school and is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the law hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well. All of these law hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the law hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and the editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, I'm talking about the Czech story. Well, in 1933, under the New Deal, President Roosevelt called in all the gold. And all the people dutifully went down to their banks and turned in the gold for Federal Reserve notes. A voluntary act on their part, and they did it. Not everybody did, but most did. Under threat of law. If you don't do this, we're going to do something bad, wicked, terrible, awful, and evil to you. Nobody quite knew what they were going to do, but everybody was afraid, and so everybody went down and did it. Now, what would have happened had they not done that? What if the people had said, well, we're not going to accept these Federal Reserve notes, and we're not going to participate in this discharge. We're going to participate in just weights and balances. We're not going to practice the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. We're going to continue to practice the 10 Commandments. I mean, the people could have done that. It's kind of like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You know, they refused to worship the image. Daniel refused to comply with the state's statutes. And he went into the lion's den, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego went into the fiery furnace. And I was telling my students, you know, if you can't go to jail, you can't do this. You have to be able to stand up and say, no, that's wrong, and here's why it's wrong, because here's what the Bible and God clearly teaches us. This is what I'm going to do. Now, to bring it under the free exercise clause, you could do that and get away with it, but you probably don't know how. Let's take a little look here at these Federal Reserve notes. A Federal Reserve note, or Federal Reserve notes, are a first and paramount lien on all of the assets of the issuing Federal Reserve Bank. So says Moody's Bank and Financial Manual, page 2105. So these Federal Reserve notes are just like that 3x5 card. They are an obligation of the Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve notes and national bank notes may be used to pay an obligation evidenced by usual form of promissory note. So says Beery versus Los Angeles County in 1953. In State versus Thomas, we found out that, number one, money was property, and Federal Reserve notes are only a claim on property. And three, Fed notes shall be redeemed in lawful money, not legal tender. State versus Thomas, 12 U.S.C. 411. So a Federal Reserve note, like a 3x5 card, is a discharge. And it is a claim upon money, but it is not the money itself. It's like a hat check, you know, when you go in and check your hat and coat. The claim check is redeemable in one hat and coat, but it is not the hat and coat, and it won't keep you very warm. Now, the Internal Revenue Service Code at Section 1.1001-1, 4657, CCH, states that Federal Reserve notes are valueless. Did you know that? Federal Reserve notes are valueless as a matter of law. They have no value at all. Zero. Now, the fact that you accept them and you ascribe a value to them is up to you. I came to the conclusion that that indeed is true. Federal Reserve notes are valueless, and when you come to school here, we don't take Federal Reserve notes, checks, and credit cards. We just take gold and silver coin. Gold and silver coin. Federal Reserve notes shall be obligations of the United States and shall be redeemed in gold or lawful money. Section 16, 173, 38 Statute 251, Chapter 6. Did you know? Federal Reserve notes shall be obligations of the United States. And as a citizen of the United States, all those Federal Reserve note dollars that Ben Bernanke, you know, Helicopter Ben, is out there creating are obligations of the United States. Let's hear it for citizenship in the United States. Now, citizenship is like membership in a club. I talked about that last time. I mean, if you want to join, if you want to be a member of the Isabella, Missouri After Dinner Club, you can certainly do that, but when the members of the club vote for you to pay for dinner out of your pocket, you're going to be one sad puppy, you know that? And when the United States of America goes belly up, which it absolutely will without a doubt, default on its debt just like Argentina did in 2001, and the old Soviet Union did in 1990. It'll go into receivership. And then there's going to be some new owners of all the toys out there. Just wanted to let you know that. That's what checks are all about. Checks are liabilities and insurance. Final analysis. Now, Federal Reserve notes may be refused, so says McLeod versus Hoover, cited at 105 South 205. That's a Louisiana case. Federal Reserve notes may be refused. And if you come here to this law school and you say, I want to go to school here, Mr. Gordon, and I'm going to offer you Federal Reserve notes, they will be refused. We don't take them here. Hell, I'd take a Russian ruble or an Indian rupee or an English pound before I'd take a Federal Reserve note. They may be refused, and they ought to be, in my view. Now, there's a number of interesting stories that we can tell about money over here, but let's take a look at some famous quotations on money. People, you know, they're pretty knowledgeable about money. I mean, you got a checking account and you work and you get a paycheck, you know, every so often. You deposit your money in the bank and every once in a while you cash it, go down to your ATM and get some Federal Reserve notes. You know, maybe even once in a while you go down to Joe the gold broker and buy a gold coin or a silver coin, and maybe you've actually got one or two of those. Most people do not. 95% of the people of the United States of America own no gold and no silver. All of the gold and silver coin, all of the gold and silver period in America, is in the hands of 5% of our population. The other 95% do not get paid, are not going to get paid, have never been paid, and in all probability will never be paid for their labor, their services, or for any of their goods. They don't deal in payment, they deal in discharge. This is not a plea to you to quit discharging with Federal Reserve notes and to go back to payments with gold. As an educator, I'm just here to explain to you the legal consequences. That's all. Legal consequences. Now, last time I showed you that if you don't want to pay for dinner down at Pizza Hut, you don't want to be a member of the Isabella, Missouri After Dinner Club, because if you are, and they have a lawful vote and under the bylaws of your club, and you're incorporated and you're registered and regulated and you got a birth certificate and a marriage license and a driver's license, anytime, boys and girls, you join the club, then you're bound by the rules and regulations. Now, you know, most of you people are not subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the UCMJ. And that's because you're not members of the military service. So if you'd like to join that club, go down to your local Army recruiter and join the Army. Sign the contract. And then, when you get to basic training, and they say, peel potatoes, and you say, no, no, not by the hair on my chinny chin chin will I peel potatoes or open my footlocker for an inspection, absent a Fourth Amendment search warrant, you just watch what happens to you next, Charlie. You know, you got a birth certificate. You just watch what happens to you next, Sally. You got a driver's license, and now you're going to tell the highway cop to stuff it, huh? You got a marriage license, and you're going to tell social lady which end is up, eh? Now, you know, boys and girls, if you want to join these clubs, that's fine. But the monetary club, that's your bank account, your checking account, your Social Security account, your use of Federal Reserve notes, your checks that you're writing. If you want to join the national economy, it's okay by me. But there are some legal obligations that you ought to be aware of. Here's a few of them. In 1700, Mayor M. Chell Rothschild said this. He said, you permit me to issue and control the money of a nation, and I care not who makes its laws. Well, that banker was pretty confident that if he could issue the money of England, he didn't care who was making the laws of England. Thomas Jefferson said, I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. And already they have raised up a money aristocracy that has set the government at defiance. The issuing power of money should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it belongs. Now, most of these people in the United States of America are not at defiance with the banks. They are in accord with the banks. They are in league with the banks. And they all have checking and accounts with those banks. Thomas Jefferson, he didn't think that was a good idea, but of course Jefferson wasn't as smart as most of you people out there in radio land. Dr. R.E. Sert said this. He said, when the Babylonian civilization collapsed, 3% of the people owned all of the wealth. When the old Persian Empire went down to destruction, 2% of the people owned all of the wealth. When the ancient Greeks went down to ruin, 0.5% of the people owned all of the wealth. When the Roman Empire fell by the wayside, 2,000 people owned all of the wealth of the civilized world. And it is said at this time less than 2% of the people control 90% of the wealth of America. At this time, 2% of the people of America control 90% of the wealth of America. Aristotle on usury back in 350 BC had this to say. He said, money being naturally barren, to make it breed money is preposterous and a perversion from the end of its institution, which was only to serve the purpose of exchange and not of increase. Usury is most reasonably detested as the increase arises from the money itself and not by employing the money to the purpose for which it was intended, which was a medium of exchange. Here's what the Bible says on usury in Leviticus 25, 36, and 37. It says, take you no usury of him or increase, but fear your God that your brother may live with you. You shall not give him your money upon usury, nor lend him any victuals for increase. In Deuteronomy 23:19, you shall not lend upon usury to your brother, usury of money, usury of victuals, that's property, or usury of anything that is lent upon usury. Aristotle said that it was a preposterous perversion, and your God told you not to do it. But then, of course, Bob, you're smarter than God, and obviously more intelligent than Aristotle. Now, John Adams wrote to Thomas Jefferson in 1787, he said, all of the perplexities, confusion, and distress in America arise not from defects in our Constitution or Confederation, not from want of honor or virtue, so much as from the downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, money, and circulation. That's what John Adams had to say about it. He said, it's just downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation. Thomas Jefferson said this. He said, if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation and then by deflation, the banks and the corporations will grow up around them, will deprive the people of all of their property until their children will wake up homeless on the continent that their fathers conquered. Now, boys and girls, wake up to reality because you're right on the razor edge of that event transpiring. The banking system in America is in the process of collapse right now as I speak. These banks, first by inflation, this is Helicopter Ben now, says we're going to drop money out of helicopters. They're inflating your currency by 18% a year as I speak. All right. Then by deflation, you people will take all of that currency and go into your stores and buy all of the goods. Jefferson went on to say, he says, I hope we shall crush in its birth this aristocracy of the moneyed corporations. Moneyed corporations. Microsoft, General Motors, Ford, which dare already to challenge our government to trial of strength and bid defiance to the laws of our country. That's Jefferson's letter to George Logan, dated November 1816. President Andrew Jackson had this to say. He said the following words to the money changers who approached him in the drawing room of the White House. He said, gentlemen, I have had men watching you for a long time, and I am convinced that you have used the funds of the Bank of the United States to speculate in the breadstuffs of the country. When you won, you divided the profits amongst you. And when you lost, you charged it to the bank. Now you tell me that if I take the deposits from the bank and annul its charter, I shall ruin 10,000 families. And that may be true. But gentlemen, that is your sin. But should I let you go on, you will ruin 50,000 families. And that would be my sin. You are, Jackson said, a den of vipers and thieves. And I have determined to rout you out. And by the eternal God, I will rout you out. Now that's what your seventh president had to say to the bankers. That's not what the people of America say. That's not what your presidential candidates say about Bear Stearns, about Lehman Brothers, Bank of America, and Citicorp, and Morgan Guaranty Trust. Yes, these owners of the Federal Reserve System that print and helicopter Ben distributes all of this inflationary money out here. God, we love it. Don't we? Don't we just love the abolition of all right to property, the enactment of an income tax, and our fifth plank, that is the establishment of our central bank? God, we love it. And we've exported it worldwide. James A. Garfield made this report. He said, "Whoever controls the volume of money in any country is the absolute master of all industry and commerce." And that man's name is Ben Bernanke. And he's the absolute master of all industry and commerce in this country. John Moody wrote, "Seven men on Wall Street now control a great share of the fundamental industry and resources of the United States. Three of these seven men, J.P. Morgan, James J. Hill, and George F. Baker, head of the First National Bank of New York, belong to the so-called Morgan Group. Four of them, John D. and William Rockefeller, James Stillman, head of the National City Bank, and Jacob H. Schiff on the private banking firm of Kuhn Loeb Company, to the so-called Standard Oil City Bank Group. The central machine of capital extends its control over the United States. The process is not only economically logical, it is now practically automatic." Hell, that was back in 1900, boys and girls. Hell, that was over 100 years ago. Hey, listen, there's some big things going on here. Henry Ford said the greatest thing in life is experience. Even our mistakes have value for us. Take the matter of money, for example. There's no doubt that financiers have failed to do their best to give us an efficient monetary system, and yet it was their principal business to do just that. The function of money is not to make money, but to move goods. Money is only one part of our transportation system. It moves the goods from man to man. A dollar bill is like a postage stamp. It is no good unless it will move commodities between people. If a postage stamp will not carry a letter, or money will not move goods, it is just the same as an engine that will not run. Someone will have to get out and fix it. Yep, somebody's got to get out and fix it. And by God, we got Ben Bernanke, Helicopter Ben, and he's out there fixing it right now, just printing more of it. God love him, huh? Well, there's more to be said about money in this thing called the check, and we'll take that up next time here on the Law Hour, an editorial review. I've got to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries worldwide daily over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, our schedule, and archives, and that can be accessed through our webpage at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Our time's up. We've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.